It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, the most stunning confession of censorship. Two, a day of hope, a win for free speech. But a conversation with the tech titan about the monumental job in front of Elon Musk. Three, it's one of the best days on the sports calendar. It is the NFL draft, and I give you the players to watch and the perfect draft for the Dallas Cowboys. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. Welcome to a rebirth. Welcome to a day of hope. But welcome to the beginning. As always, I hope you will download, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your audio entertainment. Apple, Spotify, or Fox News Podcasts. Or watch the Will Cain Podcast on Rumble and YouTube. Today is a beginning, a day of hope. It is a day of hope for almost every franchise in the NFL. More on that coming up just a little bit later here in the Will Cain Podcast. But it is a day of hope as it is a win and a beginning in the fight for free speech. You have to listen to our conversation with tech titan David Sacks as to why he believes Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter represents the fall of the Berlin Wall, but not the fall of the Soviet Union. But first, story number one. You simply have to hear this sound from MSNBC's Ari Melber. The host of a show on MSNBC gives voice to the absolute meltdown taking place on the left over this day of victory for free speech. There's so much honesty and revelation and confession in the reaction of Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter. I think the freakout among the left, the meltdown, represents they were never that interested in the concept of free speech in the first place. And it's also an admission that they were living under a world that was absolutely protected and biased. I can speak for many of us out there. In the 24 to 36 hours since the formalization of Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter, we have seen, oddly, voices on the left lose Twitter followers, and voices on the right, like my own, elevated and gain a significant percentage of new followers within a short amount of time. What does that reflect? What does that mean? It means that our content has been turned down, that we have been shadow banned, that our voices have been muted, while other voices have been elevated artificially. Now, I want you to understand that reality set against this dystopian future as painted by MSNBC's Ari Melber. Listen.
You own all of Twitter or Facebook or what have you. You don't have to explain yourself. You don't even have to be transparent. You could secretly ban one party's candidate or all of its candidates, all of its nominees. Or you could just secretly turn down the reach of their stuff and turn up the reach of something else, and the rest of us might not even find out about it till after the election. Elon Musk says this is all to help people because he is just a free speech, philosophically clear, open-minded helper.
In taking to his primetime show, Melber describes the ability of one man to completely silence, to push off the platform candidates for presidency of the United States, candidates up and down the ticket. Some voices, some stuff, as he describes it, turned down, while other voices, other stuff, turned up. He talks about this all happening and no one even knowing about it until after an election. Does he own a mirror? Is there any semblance of self-awareness? Did he participate in the last 5 years of history? What he has described as his dystopian vision of the future under Elon Musk is the dystopian past that most of us have lived through over the past 5 years. I don't have to lay it out for you. We all know the president of the United States, not just a candidate, but the president of the United States was kicked off every technology platform. Voices out there across the spectrum on the right have been booted off of various social media platforms, including Twitter. And people have been absolutely muted and silenced and shadow banned. And that has become clear as our voices have been unleashed in the last 36 hours, as our voices have been turned back up to neutral. Melber has to know what he describes as this horrible vision of the future is the reality of the recent past. It's comedy. I mean, it truly is. That is the comedy of a lack of self-awareness. Can that be real? Is that not parody? Is that not satire? You don't say, Ari. Get out, Ari. Can you imagine, Ari? Yes, we lived it. We've lived it for the past 5 years, and now that Elon Musk promises an absolute guarantee of free speech, all we've done is gone back to neutral. Your artificially inflated numbers have been turned back to neutral, and our artificially muted voices have been turned back to neutral. And all of us can now have this forum, a public square, where we can have an arena for a battle of ideas. Why is that so scary? Why is that dystopian? There was never a principle for many of you on the left, not all of you, but many of you on the left. There was only power. And if you're the beneficiary of power, then you are the victor. And if you are, well, on the outside of power, you are defeated. Lucky for you that a corporate CEO who is a billionaire, who believes in the absolute value of free speech and has the strength to stand up against employees and regulators and customers and politicians and fellow billionaires and Wall Street financiers and advertisers and corporatists, who has a spine, has purchased Twitter. And now all he promises to do is turn it back to neutral. Is that so scary? Welcome to the new world. Not dystopia, but as close as we can get in the past 5 years to utopia.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain podcast.
Did you know that every major diaper company either financially or vocally supports abortion? If that appalls you and you're looking to support a baby brand that aligns with your pro-life, pro-family views, then Every Life is your solution. Every Life firmly believes that regardless of where someone is from, what they look like, or whether they were planned or unplanned, every baby is a miracle from God worthy of love, protection, and celebration. Every Life offers high-performing, supremely soft, premium diapers and wipes delivered right to your doorstep. Their diapers are crafted without fragrances, dyes, lotions, latex, parabens, or phthalates. And you can feel good knowing that every purchase with Every Life contributes to changing lives through their support of pro-life organizations and pregnancy resource centers. Every Life is not just changing diapers, they're changing lives. Visit everylife.com to learn more. That's everylife.com. And don't forget to use promo code Duffy10 for an exclusive 10% discount on your first order today.
Story number two. David Sacks is a tech pioneer, a tech titan who's been involved in various companies such as PayPal. He now is the CEO of a startup called Call-In, a podcasting platform that allows for interactivity with the audience. He's also the host of the All In podcast, which you can find on all of your audio mediums. David Sacks is an insider in the tech industry. And on the day after Elon Musk purchased Twitter, I wanted to talk to David Sacks about exactly what this moment represents and the monumental task that exists ahead of Elon Musk. Listen, David, great to see you again. I'm glad to have you on this day after Elon Musk buys Twitter. I want to start with your optimism. There are many of us today that are very excited. Those of us who are dedicated to the concept of free speech and understand its monumental and core place in the concept of true democracy. But you seem to be particularly optimistic. I've seen you describe this already as capitalism's self-correcting mechanism. Why so optimistic?
Yeah, and I, you know, this morning I posted that yesterday really felt like the Berlin Wall falling in cultural terms, because it was the first time that you saw somebody stand up to this galloping wave of censorship that we've been seeing over the last several years. I mean, let's go back and look at the inertia that this movement has gotten. It started several years ago with isolated cases of people who were either considered provocateurs or unlikable, like a Milo Yiannopoulos, like Alex Jones, getting deplatformed. Then it grew to the point where a sitting president of the United States was deplatformed. Then you had entire groups of working class people, like the Canadian truckers. They were financially deplatformed for expressing civil disobedience and honking their horns. Until now, more recently, you've had entire categories of thought and opinion being banned from these networks. We saw during COVID that if you expressed a dissenting or heterodox opinion about the efficacy of vaccines or cloth masks or where the virus might have come from, that you were basically censored for having that opinion, even though it later turned out to be true. You saw recently social media properties banning heterodox thought on climate change, and more recently, things like gender identity. So this movement of censorship has been growing to the point where we're not just throwing off isolated cases, but we're banning entire categories of thought. And does anybody think that it would have stopped there? It would have kept going. And finally, somebody stood up to this. And so I think so enter Elon.
And what happens now with Elon? Do you think, for example, those original provocateurs, not just President Donald Trump, but perhaps Milo Yiannopoulos and others, can and should have their accounts reinstated?
I think they will have their accounts reinstated. If you don't like what they have to say, just don't follow them, you know. But I think that the cultural repercussions of this are going to be huge, because there's something fundamentally un-American about this censorship movement that's been growing. And I think, you know, it reminds me a little bit of, it's McCarthyist, you know, what Joe McCarthy used to do. You know, in that case, in the case of Joe McCarthy, it only ultimately took one man at the right time, Joe Wells, saying to McCarthy in the Senate, "Senator, have you no shame? Have you no sense of decency?" And it basically caused that whole McCarthyist movement to crumble. So one man at the right time, saying the right thing, doing the right thing, can cause these un-American movements, this reign of terror, to end. And I think that's basically what Elon has done here.
You know, David, I really, truly do share your optimism and excitement. And I think as we progress in this conversation, I want to talk about the changes we've already seen take place in less than a 24-hour period. But I guess it's just my nature, not to be the party pooper, but it's just my nature to sort of try to tamp back on our emotional exuberance and just inject a bit of maybe skepticism, but also maybe reality. So I just want to ask you some questions about whether or not our optimism is fully, fully warranted. First of all, you are a tech titan. Do you think that many of us out there should be careful about placing all of our hopes and dreams into the hands of a billionaire? We look at Elon Musk and he says all the right things, and he seems right now to do all the right things. But for a movement that's supposed to ultimately protect not just our principles, but the people, should we reserve some skepticism that our savior is yet another billionaire?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it would be better if this had happened in a, let's say, different, more democratic way, if you want to put it that way. I mean, Jack Dorsey himself, in endorsing Elon's takeover of the company, said that it would be better if Twitter was more of an open protocol, or if this had somehow happened in a more democratic way. But those options weren't available. And the fact of the matter is, if you look at all the competing social media sites, they are, or not just social media sites, but prestige newspapers like the Washington Post, like the New York Times, they're all billionaire owned. They're all controlled by, you know, tech oligarchs and billionaire money. And so there's nothing different about Twitter in that respect. I mean, Twitter has also been more or less controlled by its billionaire founders. The difference here is Elon's intentions. And he has no reason to state these intentions unless he's serious about them, because he's being demonized for it. He's being attacked from all the usual quarters for basically, you know, being a racist, or, you know, you have people threatening not him, not just about Twitter, but also potentially threatening his other businesses like Tesla. So he's bringing a lot of heat on himself, which he did not need to do unless he was serious about the principles he's invoking here.
You mentioned Jack. What do you think the role was of Jack Dorsey in this takeover by Elon Musk?
I think it's very interesting. I think he published a tweet storm just, I think it was last night, in a pretty long tweet storm in which he clearly endorsed Elon's takeover of the company. That leads me to believe that he was working behind the scenes in favor of it. And maybe from the beginning, I'm not sure when that began, but I think Elon and Jack have a good relationship. I think they're friends or friendly. And clearly Jack supports what Elon's doing and has likely been supported throughout the process.
You know, Jack's an interesting figure, David. I'm sure you know Jack Dorsey, but maybe in a way, Jack being so hard to pin down is why I want to reserve some level of skepticism for Elon, what I think is healthy skepticism. Again, I'm as enthusiastic as everyone else is today, but I look at the power that we give a savior, and I think to myself, what a savior gives, a savior can take away. And maybe we just need to look to Jack as an example of that, because Jack today seems to be this warrior for the integrity of Twitter and on the side of free speech. But it was Jack, and under Jack's influence and guidance, that Twitter began this process of censorship. It was Jack, I believe, at least under his influence, where Twitter booted the leader of the free world and the president of the United States and Donald Trump. So what am I supposed to make of Jack Dorsey?
I agree with you. I think Jack is a real puzzle, a real enigma. You're right. I mean, it was under his watch as CEO that Trump was deplatformed and many other people were deplatformed. And this whole movement of so-called trust and safety and the idea that people expressing, you know, wrong think harmed users in the community, that all gained steam and took off under his administration as CEO. And yet, at various other times, he would do things like make statements in support of free speech. He later made, I don't know if it was an apology, but sort of regretful statements, I would say thoughtful statements about the repercussions of deplatforming a sitting president of the United States. He did apologize for Twitter taking down the Hunter Biden story before the election. So, you know, Jack has always been a bit of a puzzle here. And, you know, I think my interpretation of it is that Jack generally has, I would say, noble sentiments when it comes to free speech, but he never followed through with them as an executive, as the leader of that company. And I think that may have something to do with the fact that as a leader, he's just very hands-off. He's just not very operationally, you know, he's just not that kind of manager. And so as a result, it felt like the staff of Twitter really got to run the show. And I think Elon's a very different kind of leader. Elon is incredibly hands-on at all of his companies. And I think he is much better at driving the company to the outcome he wants. And so whatever was going on with Jack, you know, whether he's had a change of heart or whether he was simply unable to follow through on his vision and sentiments, Elon is not going to have that problem. Elon is a very hands-on manager. And if the team does not believe in the mission that Elon has stated, he will go get a new team.
I defer to your firsthand knowledge of these characters and these individuals, but I will tell you, I have a slightly different interpretation because I think it's more reflective of what's happening in society at large. And that is, I can't speak to whether or not Jack was a hands-on manager, but I think we have a pandemic of corporate weakness, CEO weakness going on across this country. My suspicion is, and this is more sort of an aggregate diagnosis instead of Jack as a human being, that we have CEOs that are running scared of their employees, that they are absolutely showing a level of spinelessness that's endemic to our entire culture right now. And maybe that's why Jack could at least profess the love of the principles of free speech without actually implementing it within Twitter. And then that leads me to this. Elon, by the way, shows none of those same weaknesses. He seems to be very, very strong. However, just as a management perspective, let's tie these two things together. I think it's my interpretation, David, that Twitter's policy of censorship was one, as much as it was directed top down, it's part of the culture from the bottom up. In other words, what Elon is stepping into are low-level Twitter employees who are in love with the idea of a safe space or mental health that then manifests in the form of censorship. They've implemented that into policies. I just wonder how much effect can Elon truly have when what he's probably has to do is root out an entire culture, not a few senior managers. This isn't a Parag problem. I'm sure it is to some degree. But this is a problem all the way down to the cubicle at the bottom of Twitter that I think Elon is going to have to address.
So I agree with you. 100% agree with what you just said. I think there is an epidemic of spinelessness in corporate America. I know plenty of these CEOs, and they're in, you know, Signal or groups or WhatsApp groups with disappearing messages where they say what they really think, but publicly they're not willing to come out and say what they really think. They're pushed around and bullied by the employees. Every time they form a boycott or letter writing campaign, they kowtow to that. We saw that happen with Disney just in the last couple of weeks with Bob Chapek. He had the right idea in Florida, which was just to stay out of that whole debate, that whole controversy, but he was mau-mau by the employees to get involved, and he did, and then he got spanked by DeSantis, and now Disney's going to suffer real economic consequences for that. So you've seen over and over again that these CEOs get pushed around by employees. I can tell you that's just not going to happen with Elon. He's just not that kind of leader. He's a very strong, hands-on leader. He defines the leadership always starts with him defining the principle. At SpaceX, we're going to get people to Mars. I mean, that really is the mission. At Tesla, the mission was we're going to accelerate the world's transition to sustainable energy. And at Twitter, he's now defined the mission as the restoration of Twitter as a global town square that is, you know, a place people, it's an open marketplace of ideas. He said that's the cornerstone of democracy. So he has now defined the mission. And I think you will see him now drive that mission through the company. And if people are not on board with it, they're going to be getting off the train.
So that has to mean people are going to start losing jobs at Twitter. And then it brings me to this. You know, I think I saw the stat, David, something like 98.7% of Twitter employees have donated to the Democratic Party, which, by the way, makes Twitter somewhat extreme, but not crazy extreme within the realm of your industry, Silicon Valley. Yes. The only company, by the way, that was worse than Twitter, I believe, was Netflix. But even as you go down, you're talking about all of these companies, Facebook, and not just, again, social media companies, overwhelmingly contributing to Democratic Party candidates. And then that brings me to this. Do you think Elon Musk is going to have a problem hiring? Let's say he does get rid of these employees who have created this culture, this cancer of censorship. Where does he go to hire employees? It seems like your entire industry, from the recruiting base, going into college and coming out into this industry, is devoted to this ideology.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That is the deeper societal problem, is this professional class hegemony. All of our institutions are run by college graduates, members of the professional class. If you look at polling of what the professional class believes, it's in stark contrast to what the working class of this country believes. Very diametrically opposed. Now, the good news for people who have more traditional, let's say, working class views, is that the working class of this country is about 2/3 of the country and the professional class is 1/3. However, the professional class controls all the institutions. That is the fundamental battleground in American society today. That is what causes all the strife, is that the elites are fundamentally in tension. What they want is fundamentally in tension with what the average American wants. And they are trying to impose their views by any means necessary, which includes censorship, right? So that is the fundamental tension. But let me just say this. I think that Elon will be able to find enough staff to run Twitter. And remember, Twitter's got something like 8,000 employees and nobody knows what they all do. I mean, how many employees does Twitter really need? So you start with the fact that Elon probably only needs 2,000 employees at this company, 3,000, at most 4,000 employees. So he can spare, you know, half the company. And so he does not need to staff 8,000 employees. He can make this company work with 2,000 employees. And that gives him a lot of flexibility, I think.
Which, by the way, is a testament to whether or not this company was a well-run capitalist enterprise in and of itself. If your employee base, by the way, is fat by an extent of 50% or more, wow, that's a shocking indictment of this company. Which, by the way, what do you think about this?
That's what gives him the economic ability to do this transaction as a basically a leveraged buyout, as a take private transaction, is because the company doesn't, normally you couldn't do a private equity takeout like this because a company like Twitter doesn't have enough free cash flow to support that level of debt. But if Elon can basically increase free cash flow by reducing the size of the staff by, say, 50%, he can immediately make the transaction pay for itself. So I think that, I without having talked to him about this, I would have to guess that's part of the plan.
You know, that was actually where I was going to go with this next question. I think that Twitter now represents 20% of Elon Musk's net worth. I just wonder about this as a business proposition for him. Set aside the cultural and censorship issues, but as a business proposition for him. And this is where I'm over my skis, but that's why you're my guest. Tech has never been built on the concept of reducing expenditures on your way to riches. Tech has actually been an industry built upon sort of the next guy coming along to pay a higher price in equity for whatever you have. It's not really a let's make sure our margins are in the black kind of business. But you think that he can make this work, which I think he needs to, right? I mean, if it's a fifth of your net worth, this has to work as a business. He can say, and there are clips of him out there saying this isn't about economics, which sounds noble, but a fifth of your net worth is going to be about economics at some point. And so you think, by the way, there's just enough fat to cut to make Twitter work?
I think probably that's the key to making this deal work financially, is cutting all the fat, because I think that would immediately boost their free cash flow significantly, and that would allow them to pay for a large part of the deal. Now, I agree with you, though, that Elon here is taking a lot of financial risk. He's paying a large premium for this company. I think if you look at it, was 38% premium from the time he announced, but if you look at from the time he started accumulating stock, it was like something like a 54% premium. So he's paying a substantial premium. By the way, the stock market's been terrible the last couple of weeks. Even in the 2 weeks since he made this offer, the market's been going down. It looks like we're headed into a recession. And then furthermore, Twitter is supposed to announce earnings on Thursday. Those earnings must have been underwhelming, or they wouldn't have taken his offer so fast. So I think, yes, he is buying himself a big economic, from an economic standpoint, I think this deal is buying himself a big headache that he didn't need. But I also think that I really take him at his word that the reason he's doing this is not to make more money. He's got plenty of money. It is because of Twitter's cultural impact. He wants to see it restored to being a free speech platform, because that is fundamental to our democracy. That is why he's doing this. Now, along the way, I think he will figure out how to make it work for him as a business. If you look at what he did with Tesla and SpaceX, and just full disclosure, I'm a investor in SpaceX. You know, SpaceX, the goal from the beginning is to get to Mars. You would think that would be a spectacularly unprofitable mission. But he figured out in building SpaceX how to make it work as a business. So he came up with the launch business, putting payloads in space. And then he came up with the satellite business, Starlink. And it's looking like it's going to be a fantastic business. He did the same thing with Tesla, right? He wanted to transition the world's sustainable energy. And in the process of doing that, he built the world's best car. So it always starts with the mission with Elon, but then he figures out, how do I make this a good business along the way? I think he'll do the same thing with Twitter.
So I want to go back to some of my skepticism. And again, this really isn't about this not being a celebratory day. This is a wonderful day for the concept of free speech. But I just don't want to wake up and feel betrayed, you know, some couple weeks later, and not just by Elon, but by reality. So in other words, all of those power centers you talked about, both from on high and from in the cubicle on floor three, all of those power centers are obviously very dedicated to the concept of censorship. And I can't just believe that they're going to let go because now Elon Musk has entered the building. So what I mean is, even if it's not the employees that Elon Musk has to wrangle, I saw you interacting, by the way, with Mark Andreessen about this. I think that the push for censorship, like squeezing a balloon, just probably moves somewhere else. Doesn't it move higher up the food chain to ISPs or to browsers? Doesn't it move somewhere else in the technology food chain? Look, when we saw President Trump deplatformed, it wasn't just him kicked off at the client-facing social media platforms. I mean, we saw Amazon go after Parler. We saw absolutely free speech platforms lose their ability to exist on the internet. Don't you think this censorship move just moves deeper?
So, I mean, I think you're right that we have a class of people who are deeply invested in this idea of censorship. And again, it comes back to the professional class in America holds views that are deeply antithetical to what the majority, I'd say the progressive wing of the professional class holds views that are deeply antithetical to what most Americans think. And like any outnumbered group in a democracy that wields institutional power, they're trying to protect themselves through censorship. They're trying to suppress the other side because that's how they maintain power. You're right. They're not going to give up censorship very easily because that would be tantamount to giving up power. So I'm not saying that, okay, Elon managed to take over Twitter and now we've just won this battle. It's going to be a hard fought battle for many years. But, you know, for me, this, you know, I feel like this is a moment of hope because, again, you had this galloping censorship where they're going from deplatforming individuals to a president to entire categories of thought. And it felt like we were just putty in their Orwellian hands. Every week it seemed like they were banning a new category of thought or opinion, and nobody was saying anything about it. And now we have, right. Elon standing up here and drawing a line in the sand and saying, no, you know, this is un-American. Free speech is one of our fundamental values. We're going to fight for it. And I do think, like that moment, you know, when Joe Wells stood up to Joe McCarthy, it was sort of an emperor wears no clothes moment. At the end of the day, the vast majority of Americans are on the side of free speech, and I think they can be rallied to this cause. And so I think this is the beginning of the end. It's certainly not the end, but I think it's the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of an effective resistance against the censorship movement. And remember, the Soviet Union didn't collapse until 2 years after the Berlin Wall fell. So there was still plenty of work to do. I think this is sort of more of a Berlin Wall moment than the Soviet Union collapsing moment. But I think it's the beginning of the end for this regime of censorship.
I love that message, and I share your hope. And by the way, I think we've seen that hope already begun to play out in the real world. I don't know, David, what you've seen happen with your personal account, but it's literally been 24 hours, and I've added a significant percentage of followers. It is not on pace with what was happening before. And there's a friend of mine named Nick Rizzuto who's keeping a tally of this, of conservative voices, or I don't even know if they all have to be conservative, non-approved as defined by support of the current thing, voices, who are seeing an explosion in the number of followers and engagement in a 24-hour period. And it makes me wonder, will Elon expose exactly what was going on inside of Twitter? Will we see the algorithms or the source code or the shadow banning? Will we get to see exactly what's been going on for the past decade? In intensity over the last 2 years, but the past decade?
So you're right. You bring up an issue which I think is very important, which is it's easy to see when somebody gets deplatformed. If you're just thrown off the platform like Trump was, we can all see that. But what we don't know, what we don't have access to, are all the subtle rules, the way that the algorithm works about who gets upvoted, who gets downranked. You take Google search results. We know that they are engaging. It's not just the algorithm that basically ranks all the search results. They engage in human interventions. We have no idea what those rules are. We have no idea what they're doing. They're putting their thumb on the scale of American democracy by upranking, content that they like and downranking content they don't like. We, given their power as a monopoly, we need to know what they're doing. What Elon is doing here with Twitter is he said, I'm going to open source the algorithm. I'm going to let people see what is happening. So if content gets taken down, we'll get to see, was that because of the algorithm? Was that because of human intervention? He's providing transparency, and transparency means accountability. We have no transparency into the decisions of big tech today. When they take decisions of enormous consequence to our democracy, we have the right to know that. And again, Elon's not doing it for all big tech companies, but by starting with Twitter, he's creating an example that hopefully we can now extend to the rest of these big tech companies.
But what will be the reaction, in your estimation, David, of the quote-unquote regime, of this class of elites that you describe that are so dedicated to the concept of censorship? Back to what I said a moment ago, do you think there will be a push to use Amazon, for example, to push people off of cloud services? Or do you think, in fact, speaking of headaches for Elon Musk, look, both the left and the right have wanted to see some form of regulation for big tech. And in fact, I think if I'm listening to you closely, you might be in support of that because you just said and described many of these companies as a monopoly. The right wants it to happen so that there'll be less censorship, but the left wants it because they want more censorship. So do you think we're going to move? Will this, the squeezing of the balloon, Will we see cloud services begin to kick free speech platforms off? Will Elon Musk risk that when it comes to cloud service hosting? Or will the government step in now and Democratic politicians really push through on cracking down on regulating big tech?
So you're right that censorship has already occurred at the hosting level. So you remember when Parler got thrown off, they not only got delisted from the Apple and Android app stores, they also got booted off AWS, you know, the Amazon web hosting service. So that is already happening, and I agree, it's like it's just one more example of this censorship taking place. It's so disturbing. Now, it will be interesting to see whether if Elon is effective here at making Twitter the free speech platform that he says, will the battle then shift to the operating system layer? Because you're right that Apple and Google could then kick Twitter out of the App Store. I don't think they could kick him off the internet, because I don't know if Twitter's using AWS or not. If they are, even if Amazon were to boot Twitter off, Twitter has such scale that they could create their own, you know, hosting centers. You know, they could go, it wouldn't be pleasant, but they could go in and create their own colos at telecom companies and get on the internet directly. So I'm not worried about Twitter being kicked off the internet. I mean, that's, the internet excels at being that kind of open platform. But I guess you're right that the battle could shift to the app stores, and it'll be interesting to see. I would just think that if Apple and Google tried to boot Twitter out of Elon Musk Twitter, out of their app stores, the backlash would be so intense that I have a hard time believing they would try. But I think it'll be interesting to see. I think they're much more willing to boot off a little company like Parler, you know, that that doesn't have the scale and the defenders that that Elon has. But you're right, that will be one of the battles to come.
What about the government? I mean, we have heard Nancy Pelosi and many Democrats apply the bully pulpit pressure onto Facebook, and then in essence forcing companies like Facebook to begin the self-regulation process in hopes, I think, of avoiding a government regulation. Do you think we see increased pressure for government regulation?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the pressure for the censorship has really comes from the top down. And we've seen the CEOs of social media companies like Zuckerberg, like Dorsey, like Sundar, they get hauled up in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and they get berated by these senators. Why are you allowing this content up there and that content up there? As if these platforms are responsible for every single piece of user-generated content that gets posted on their platforms. And, you know, so they keep getting hauled up there and lectured to take down more content. And then, you know, in virtually the same breath, they get warned by the senators on these committees that these companies are monopolies and they're subject to regulation. Basically, they're hanging a sword of Damocles over their heads saying, unless you do what we want you to do on content moderation, we're going to basically punish you in some other way. That is one of the nefarious things happening here. The only way to get a change on that is just to have a different party in the majority. And I think there's a good chance that you'll see that after November. You know, I don't think that Republicans should cooperate with the Democrats on Section 230 reform, even though there is a need to reform Section 230, because I just think that Republicans and Democrats have completely different objectives on that. So I think you're right that a lot of the pressure comes from Congress, but that Congress can change. Voters can change that. And I expect that voters will change that in November.
Back to the cloud service hosting and the power of the operating systems and all of the behind-the-scenes mechanics when it comes to censorship. What did you make of Jeff Bezos yesterday chiming in out of the blue somewhat that did Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter mean that now China has inordinate power over Twitter? And he pointed to the fact that much of Tesla's product was manufactured in China. By the way, and I'll let you expound upon what you made of it, but we should take a moment to point out how much of Amazon's business is dependent upon China. And by the way, how much Jeff Bezos has accommodated China in changing his own business, banning certain books at the behest of the Chinese Communist Party. But it is significant that a billionaire, one of the world's richest men in Jeff Bezos, chose this moment and this particular news cycle and this particular news item to go, wonder if this gives too much power to China.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's hard to find a product that's not made in China on Amazon. I mean, my response to it was that the Bezos Post doesn't like getting disintermediated by Elon, right? Because the way that people ultimately go to the way that Amazon, that rather, the Washington Post gets, which is owned by Bezos, they get traffic is through sites like Twitter. People, you know, tweet the articles. He doesn't like the idea that Elon now owns a property that disintermediates him. These two have had a rivalry going back to the rocket business. Bezos has a company called Blue Origin. Elon obviously has SpaceX. Elon has, you know, made fun of Bezos, as he has Bill Gates and other billionaires. So they have sort of a rivalry. I thought what was interesting is that Bezos was in the process of getting ratioed for that that tweet attacking Elon. You could see that there were like a number of people responding to him, including my response, that were really gaining on him. And then he responded to his own question by saying, oh, well, no, I don't think it'll have much impact. You know, he sort of backed off. Do you see that? So he was about to lose big time. And it was the only thing he could have done that would have been more abject groveling was if he had deleted his tweet in the first place.
Many have pointed out, by the way, the Washington Post runs this, or has run in the past, this this essentially a print version of an infomercial for the Chinese Communist Party for many years. I think it's millions of dollars every year for them to run the China Daily or something like that, which is a propaganda rag put out by the Chinese Communist Party and inserted into the Washington Post. It's hypocrisy at its finest, but it does give me concern, because yet here's another element of our society, the billionaire class. A particular billionaire, but the billionaire class, who's rejecting the concept, again, of free speech. And so to go back kind of to where you and I had the more 30,000-foot level conversation, how is this possible, David? I mean, just how is it possible that you have a society where the vast majority of people who are involved in the business in the industry of big tech, who are involved in high-level academia, who are involved in foundational level public policy, and Mark Andreessen again had pointed this out, who are involved in high levels of government, you know, behind the scenes permanent jobs, who are quote unquote experts, who are in media. How is it every single one of the biggest powers outside of, I guess, largely the oil and gas industry, but every other industry that holds the biggest levers of power in the United States of America all share a similar ideology, and it is an ideology today that runs in fear of free speech?
I think it's a great question. And what I would say is that what it comes down to is that the fundamental quid pro quo of our civilization is that in order to advance professionally, you have to go to college and get a professional degree with, you know, all the economic rewards and social advancement that brings. And when you go to college, you get indoctrinated into a set of ideologies. I mean, the universities are controlled and have been controlled for 30 or 40 years by basically radical leftists. And so that is why all of the institutions that are downstream of the universities that are run by people with professional degrees, they basically share this ideology, and it, you know, to varying degrees. Sometimes they're outright activists. Other times they just kind of go along with it, because they're sort of sympathetic to it. Sometimes they're just afraid to buck it because they don't want to get called out. But that fundamentally is the issue, is we have a professional class that's been indoctrinated into this radical ideology. It is not the ideology of most Americans. Most Americans, again, the working class, which is the vast majority of this country, does not share this ideology, but the professional class does. And that is, I think, why it is very, very difficult, is how do you turn around a country where all the institutions are led by people who hold views that are fundamentally antagonistic to the views of most Americans? That is the conundrum in which we find ourselves. But part of the answer is we have to create a counter elite. You're never not going to have some kind of elite, but we have to create a counter elite. And this is where I think people like Elon are helpful, is we can't have every single billionaire basically being a member of this professional class, this woke professional class. We need to create alternative leadership. And this is where people like Elon are very helpful.
You know, I think I agree with you 60 to 70% of the way on that. I think that's certainly part of the picture. I love the idea of a counter elite. I really love the idea of a counter anything, of the prevailing current thing. But maybe it's the growing populist in me. I look at this problem and I think it certainly is a top-down problem of the elite. But I also worry about this movement of censorship and this movement of growing narcissistic authoritarianism that exists within all of us, one that's coming from the bottom up in addition to the top down. I think a lot of these kids, and I don't like to be the generational warrior, but I think a lot of these kids come into college already honoring the idea of a safe space and placing mental health above the idea of exposure to challenging ideas. By the time they arrive at college, they're running the show. I think most professors, by the way, today, maybe not 10 years ago, but today, they're running afraid of their students. I think like that epidemic of weakness with CEOs, we're seeing an epidemic of weakness within academia as well, where they're terrified of the three students in the seminar of 100 who may be offended by something that you say. And I think to myself, this is what Elon Musk steps into. He steps into the problem of, yes, elite pressure from regulators and other billionaires, but he also steps into the problem of a bottom-up Gen Z safe space cubicle environment among all of his employees. And then he's got the compounding problem, David, of a user base. Right now, they say that Twitter's user base is D plus 43. I believe that's the number, which makes it more radically liberal than San Francisco and Bernie Sanders, you know, home district. It's insanely liberal. So he's got top-down pressure, bottom pressure, and market pressure all pushing against what we thought was a universal value in free speech.
I think that's well said. I think that is what is going to make this very difficult. I just wouldn't underestimate Elon's willpower. And the ability of one, one man with a righteous cause standing up to a mob, because this is ultimately what this is. This is basically a mob of people engaged in groupthink. So, you know, sometimes that's all it really takes is that person. And I think he will ultimately drive this agenda through the company. He needs to slash the number of employees anyway. So people who are not on board are going to get off the train. And but you're right. It's gonna be a hell of a battle. It's really interesting to see. I do think that you mentioned these cases of, for example, these university professors who get, three students complain about them, teaching them a view they don't like, and they call that harm, and then they get them, thrown out of the university. You know, that wouldn't happen if the people running the universities, if the university presidents, if the university administrators just took a tough stand and said no. You know, we don't consider it to be harm for you to encounter views that expand your mind, So that is all it really takes is people to stand tough. And I think Elon is providing a role model and will, I think, continue as CEO of Twitter or as the leader of Twitter to provide that role model. And I think this is ultimately where the cultural impact may be greatest, is because not just the additional free speech that's allowed on Twitter, but the free speech that now gets allowed on other platforms, and the leadership model he creates of standing up to the mob, and him role modeling that behavior for a lot of other people. This is why I think it could be a watershed moment, is because the ripple effects, the consequences of this go so far beyond, what speech specifically Twitter allows. All these billionaires who are looking at what Elon does have to feel pretty sheepish right now. These billionaires who use their money to buy a sports team or to buy a yacht or something, but they never utter a word that's in defiance of what the New York Times or what the Washington Post thinks, because they're so concerned about their respectability and they live in terror of the New York Times writing a hit piece about them. And that's why they never do anything interesting with their money. They don't donate the money philanthropically to any charities that might actually make a difference. They just keep giving it to the same conventional causes. I think all those people have to feel really sheepish right now, because looking at what Elon's doing and the impact he's having, and they have to be thinking, why am I so afraid? Why don't I step out on a limb the way Elon has done and look at the impact I could have? If just a handful of other people get encouraged to do that based on what Elon has done, the ramifications of this could be very profound.
That, I believe, is the most hopeful message that you shared today. We both share our hope for the resurgence of free speech. But really, if we go a little bit deeper than that, what we are, as we said moments ago, is suffering from a pandemic of spinelessness and weakness. It is those schools. You're exactly right. If the administrator said, we don't care that you're offended by that seminar, then it would end. It would be over. And I would carry it even further. If you had parents out there that weren't coddling children every step of the way to protect them from any form of failure or sensitivity, then we wouldn't have this problem rising up in the freshman class at colleges. We have weakness all throughout our culture. And by the way, that weakness is going to be rewarded in the coming weeks, because Elon's going to be called a racist, a sexist. I imagine that Elon will have to deal with allegations of sexual harassment. Whatever weapon is at the disposal that you destroy courage will be marshaled against Elon Musk. I have no doubt that will be the case, but I think you're absolutely right. Look, I played the role of devil's advocate and skeptic throughout our conversation because I try to end up being a realist, and I always want my hope grounded on solid footing. But I think that you said it best when you said this is the beginning. It's not the fall of the Soviet Union. It's the fall of the Berlin Wall. And one strong, strong individual can mark the beginning. If there are others who are strong enough to follow, and maybe in the end, that's what I should be trusting in this billionaire, not his dedication to free speech. That may, we'll see if that he holds strong to that, but maybe his strength, because we just need, we need somebody to stand firm amid this pandemic of weakness.
Yeah, and remember that back in 2016, it was another billionaire who defied the establishment and sort of became a tribune of the people in a way. That's sort of the populist movement he represented. So, you know, we're not gonna basically roll back this sort of woke elitist thinking without having any leadership at all, right? I mean, yes, we need to create a populist movement to resist it, and I trust that the vast majority of Americans ultimately are on our side in that, but that movement does need leadership, and some of those leaders are going to be billionaires, and that's a good thing. We want them on our side, not on the other side.
All right, David Sacks, really good to break down this very important beginning to, I think, one of the most seminal news events, I don't know, maybe in the last 5 years. We pointed back to what happened in 2016, maybe the most seminal news event since 2016. I always love talking to you, David. Thank you for jumping on with me today.
Great to be with you. Great to see you. Well, thank you.
Again, you can follow David Sacks on Twitter. Check out the Call In app for podcasting, or check out the All In podcast. Thank you to David Sacks.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain podcast.
Story number three. It is my favorite sporting event of the year. It is the NFL draft, and I mean that. I yesterday watched the Champions League semifinal between Manchester City and Real Madrid, and it was white knuckle from start to finish. It was such a fun, healthy, good level of tension. I love soccer, as many of you have come to know. I don't care what kind of brand that puts on me. I love it. My only real sports debate when it comes to soccer is, who do I love watching more, Kevin De Bruyne of Manchester City or the Dallas Mavericks, Luka Doncic? Both magicians, both time travelers, playing sports 3 to 4 seconds ahead of everybody else on the field, and therefore like maestros in an orchestra, conducting every single thing that happens on the field. And as much as I love football, high school, college, and pro, I have to say I think my favorite event, singular event of the year, is the first day of the NFL draft. I will watch all 3 days, but I simply love the NFL draft. All 32 teams filled with hope, everyone getting to shop for their future. And I have been preparing for this moment for months, reading mock drafts, doing simulations. And here's what I have to tell you today. I will lay out for you exactly how I hope the Dallas Cowboys draft unveils, the sequence and the players and the positions that I'd like to see through the first 3 to 4 rounds. But first, an analysis of the draft at large. This is one of the most boring drafts we've had in quite some time, and it's not hard to figure out why. There are no marquee quarterbacks in this NFL draft. Matt Corral of Ole Miss, Kenny Pickett of Pittsburgh, Desmond Ridder of Cincinnati. But the most exciting quarterback is one that might simply go mid-first round. That is Malik Wills of Liberty. I do think he has the highest upside, the highest ceiling. And if you're going to be overdrafting, and I think all of these quarterbacks are overdrafted, you might as well overdraft for the highest ceiling, not the highest floor. Quarterbacks, like our economy at large, are inflationary. They're always going to go for more than their would-be, should-be ticket price. The value in this draft isn't at quarterback, but if you're going to roll the dice, roll them on Malik Wills. Now, as to how this draft should unfold, it will be heavy on three positions. And luckily for any Dallas Cowboy fans, those three positions are three positions of need for Dallas. And that is defensive line in general, defensive end, in particular, offensive line and wide receiver. Your top 10 picks in the NFL could theoretically be made up of almost exclusively those three positions: offensive line, defensive end, and wide receiver. There is anywhere from 5 to 6 of each of those positions suspected to go within the first round, players at those positions, giving you a draft of 15 to 18 simply at those three positions. Throw in Jordan Davis and Devontae Wyatt of Georgia, defensive tackles, and there you have the top 20 players somewhere along the defensive line, offensive line, or wide receiver. It won't go down that way. Quarterbacks will be overdrafted. A few corners will be thrown in probably to the top 10 with Ahmad Garner and Derek Stingley. But the value truly lies in those three positions. At defensive end, you possibly could see the first three picks going: Aiden Hutchinson of Michigan, Kayvon Thibodeau of Oregon, and Trevon Walker of Georgia. The only thing that'll break that up is a couple of offensive linemen suspected to go in the top 5. Offensive linemen from North Carolina State, from Alabama, and others. And the way those dominoes end up falling is you would hope, if you are a Dallas Cowboys fan, that you push those positions of need into positions of value for Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones. I have played almost every mock draft simulation, and this is the sequence that I would love to see the Cowboys draft in order. In the first round, I'd love to see the Cowboys draft along the defensive line. I would love to see them take a defensive end. I think they will be at the tail end, possibly the very end of that 5 to 6 defensive ends in the run of the first round. But I think that one of the top 5 defensive ends could fall to the Cowboys' way. I'll give you the name in just a moment. The Cowboys lost Randy Gregory, and now they're running out Dante Fowler and Dorrance Armstrong. It's not good enough. Plus, you always want to be banking on the future. When the Cowboys drafted CeeDee Lamb, it wasn't because of need. It was because of value and talent. And look the way that's played since then. Amari Cooper is no longer with the team, but the Cowboys are still strong at wide receiver. Don't draft for need. You draft for talent. So between those three position groups, somewhere along the DL, OL, or WR, you should be able to get the most talented player. If something else happens and you think a linebacker like Devin Lloyd of Utah is just far and away the best player, even though you already have Micah Parsons, deal with that good problem. Take him and figure it out. Micah Parsons proved how you should not draft for need, just take the best player on the field. Cowboys didn't think they needed a linebacker. They thought still fairly highly of Jalen Smith and Leighton Vander Esch. Well, that was a bad bet. And look what they had waiting: Micah Parsons, who changed the dynamics of the entire defense in the field. So you just simply take best player available. In the second round, I'd love to see, and I think the value falls for the Cowboys to take a wide receiver. I will give you one or two names in just a moment. This is all counterintuitive because I think the singular biggest position of need for the Cowboys is offensive line. But I don't draft according to position of need, a draft according to best player available. It's a recipe with a certain amount of ingredients. You know, let's put it 75% best player available, 25% position of need. But I think there's going to be value on the offensive line still sitting there by the time you get to the third round. And again, I'm going to give you a name for each and every one of those target drafting positions. Here are some of the players that I would love to see the Cowboys have an eye on in the first round. Arnold Ebikidi, defensive end from Penn State. I think he is that defensive end at the end of that 5 or 6 deep position group in the first round. Zion Johnson of Boston College, offensive guard. Kenyon Green, guard from Texas A&M. Treylon Burks, wide receiver from Arkansas. Chris Olave, wide receiver from Ohio State. And then a name to keep an eye on, Sky Moore, wide receiver. Now, if you look at that group, what I would like to see the Cowboys do, putting my sequence in order, is take Ebikidi in the first round at 24. should he fall. In reading several draft profiles, this guy has all the measurables: fast, long, lean, hand moves, can put pressure on the quarterback. It's a prime position defensive end. Prime. Along with quarterback, and I think increasingly investments in offensive line. But this is one where you double down on your future, even if the need isn't there, obviously, and immediately today. I'd take Ebukidi in the first round. That leaves in the second round still a needed offensive line, your greatest need, and wide receiver. In the second round, I would take a wide receiver, possibly Sky Moore or George Pickens, who would be, but for an injury, one of the top wide receivers in the draft. It's possible neither of those wide receivers are going to be available. The other receivers the Cowboys are connected to, Chris Olave and Treylon Burks, will be long gone if they don't take them in the first. That leaves Moore and possibly Pickens, although he seems to be rising, for the second round. And then finally, in the third round, and I will tell you, 80% of the mock draft simulators I conducted, I took an offensive lineman in the first round. I took Zion Johnson or Kenyon Green. In the third round, I would take offensive line finally, and I would target Darian Kennard of Kentucky. Bob Sturm of The Ticket in Dallas does great draft breakdowns on The Athletic, and he's broken down something like 60 different players. Kennard tested very poorly at some of the combine and pro day measurements, but his tape, according to Sturm, is absolutely phenomenal. He is a mauler, he is good, and he is the valued offensive line there in the third round. For a bonus, I give you a fourth round pick, Charlie Kohler, tight end from Iowa State. Big, right down the seam, still can block. Ultimately give Dak an option and give the Cowboys an option should they not want to pay Dalton Schultz next year. There you go, it's four rounds and four names. Ebukidi, Moore or Pickens, Kennard, and Kohler. That's your perfect Dallas Cowboys draft. Plus, I've given you some other names there in Olave and Burks and Johnson and Green that if they don't follow that sequence, they can at least look at those players in this upcoming draft. I'm going to be excited. I'll probably jump on Instagram, see Will Cain for an Instagram Live on Thursday night for the NFL draft. We can hang out there, and I will talk about it again on Friday, although I don't know that I'll be able to record Friday's response to the draft's first round, because it will end so late before our upload on Friday morning. If that's the case, you'll get my full draft breakdown on next Monday's edition. As for your team, I'm sorry if you need a quarterback. It's just not the year. If you need a wide receiver or a defensive lineman or an offensive line, you're in luck. There are several teams like the Jets and the Eagles have multiple picks at the top of the draft who can make moves to get their guy. I just don't see this as a draft where you have a guy standing head and shoulders above everybody else that you need to trade away that quantity for quality. Have fun. It's a day of hope for free speech and for NFL fans. I'll see you again on Friday. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.